This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In many ways, individuals who come to this country as children without documentation are typical teenagers. They go to school, they play on sports teams, hang out in the mall, and text their friends. But their lives differ from their peers in some fundamental ways. They can't get driver's licenses, they can't work legally, and they could be deported any time. Last summer, the Obama administration decided to permit these young people to stay and work in the U.S. for 2 years without fear of deportation. The executive action is called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. It allows undocumented youth who meet specific criteria to apply for temporary work authorization. And today we're going to take a look at how those DACA people, those folks who have applied for DACA, have fared and how their lives have changed here in North Carolina. It's the first in a series of conversations about immigration. One young woman who applied for DACA, that DACA benefit, is Jasmine Garcia Rico, and she joins me in the studio now. Welcome, Jasmine. It's good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us how you came to the country and how old you were.
I came to the States when I was 13 years old, and I arrived to Burlington, North Carolina since then.
And what are some of the biggest challenges that you faced in Burlington as a 13-year-old without documentation?
Actually, it was a lot of things in different levels. The community was not too welcoming when I arrived. There were not many Latinos. And going to school, learning the language, not knowing how the system works, not knowing how to explain my parents, the difference between education here and back in Mexico. It was really challenging to deal with teachers and counselors. Some of them wanted to help me, but they didn't know how, how to guide me to get to college.
How about your parents? Did you have a sense? I mean, clearly they are vulnerable for deportation any time. Did they convey that to you? Do you have that sense that any minute you might have to go back?
Yeah, I was realistic all throughout high school, I think, just because the situation doesn't allow you to, you know, think something else. I knew that I had to work hard and, like, do my best, but I knew that any moment, any time, I could just be sent back, either me or any of my family members.
So you got through high school. What did you do after high school?
I applied to Guilford College in Greensboro, North Carolina. And that was the only school that I applied to. I put all my hopes in there, wanting to get an education because that was something that I had in my heart and something that my family taught me, that you have to go to college. It was not an option. So I applied and I got in. But the most challenging part was to come up with the finances to be able to afford it.
You don't get any financial aid.
No, not a state or federal.
Right. And in Guilford and other places, you don't have to put down a Social Security number so you can get in, but you got to pay the full freight.
Yeah, some private colleges don't have it in their policy that you're not allowed if you don't have documents, and Guilford didn't have it. So I was able to just apply and leave a blank.
What were your hopes? When you went to Guilford, what kind of a degree were you going for? What were you hoping to do with it?
When I first got in, I wanted to do accounting, but that didn't last too long. I changed my mind, and I majored in French and minor in business management and human resources.
So when did you first learn about DACA?
I think I was working. After I graduated from Guilford, I got a job. That wasn't what I really wanted to do, but it was what I could find at the time. And I think I was working and all my coworkers were just like listening to the news because some of them are in the same situation as me. So I think I was like on the computer the whole day trying to get work done and listening to the news.
So it's a very temporary situation. It's a 2-year program. It is not a law by any means. It's an executive. It's not even an executive order. It's a decision by the Obama administration not to deport people under certain circumstances. If you arrived in the country before you were 16 years of age, if you are now under the age of 31 or 31 and under, completed school, there's a lot of criteria, but temporary. And so it means that you have to sort of identify yourself as undocumented and
yes,
only enjoy this status of being able to work and have some ID, not be deported for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Did you worry that this would expose you, make you vulnerable?
I mean, I've been vulnerable the whole time. I feel like I've been at risk the whole time. And for years, I was waiting for a chance to do something. Even though I had a degree, it was hard to find a job that I really wanted to do. So I knew that this was like a short opportunity. Didn't know what's going to happen after, but I never actually thought about it twice, about applying. I just wanted to have the chance and make the best out of the opportunity, at least for the time.
You never thought twice about it?
Mm-mm.
Wow. Well, so there are a number of people. Jasmine is one of more than 17,000 young people here in North Carolina who applied for DACA since last year. And one of the people who helps counsel those applicants in North Carolina is Danny Moore. Danny directs the Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project at the North Carolina Justice Center, and she joins us in the studio now. Danny, welcome. It's good to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
When the announcement was made that this policy would be initiated, were you surprised by it?
Our whole team was surprised and delighted. After hearing people call our offices every week, and we have to turn so many away for immigration law services because there really just is no remedy available, we were very excited in June to hear about the announcement. But, of course, we had a lot of questions, and there were a lot of things that we wanted to know about the program and how we'd be interacting with it.
How close was I? Those are pretty much the rules. What are some of the significant rules in terms of criteria qualifying that I left out?
Well, as we were preparing to work with partners all across the state, from the mountains to the coast, we wanted to know the same things that immigrant families wanted to know. How risky was it to apply for this program? What would the benefits be? And whether most of the current Dreamers should apply or whether they should think twice about applying after living many years trying not to be noticed by immigration officials.
So, and could you counsel them right away? I mean, it seems to me that this thing, you know, sort of crosses your desk. You're having to analyze it. People are coming to you with questions. I'm guessing you didn't have answers right away.
We didn't. We were watching every day for new announcements from CIS, Citizenship and Immigration Services. They came out with FAQs, with frequently asked questions, that really guided a lot of what the legal advice would be across the state and across the country. We were looking in those for details of what we might tell families. Of course, families had a lot of questions about how strict the eligibility guidelines would be, and also if any minor traffic offenses, like driving without a license, that folks can't obtain in North Carolina would make them ineligible for the program.
Yeah, because it says you're ineligible if you've been convicted of a felony, but there's also something about multiple misdemeanors. I don't know if they put a number on that, but I guess if they didn't, then that would be a subjective judgment.
Our attorneys were wondering about this idea of significant misdemeanors. We really waited during those 2 months from June to August to see how that would be defined. And in some ways, this is a brand new area of immigration law that we've never seen in decades. So people were trying to understand what significant misdemeanors would mean in North Carolina. Guidance did come out about that, but we also needed to advise people who had more than three regular misdemeanors. And you may know in North Carolina, a lot of traffic violations are considered misdemeanors for the purposes of our courts, but may not be considered misdemeanors for the federal government and immigration purposes.
When did you feel comfortable advising families to go ahead with this? Did it take you a while to say, yeah, we think you should do this?
Well, we met with a lot of community partners to hear what they were thinking and what questions were coming up in the community. We really were, through time, we were able to develop a system with these partners of both community education, some homework for 2 or 3 weeks where people were gathering the documentation that they needed and making the decision to apply, and then a legal clinic setting in which volunteers and trained attorneys would help folks with their applications. So we envisioned a system in which there was sort of a red light, green light, and yellow light process. We wanted to green light as many applications as we could. We felt like those applicants were safe to apply, and then others would need additional legal advice in order to be safe applying.
Jasmine, tell us what you're doing now.
After I got my DACA permit, I applied for a position at the Student Action with Farm Workers as national organizer, and I am working with them right now.
Now, this is due to expire now in a year. What are your plans for the future? Have you thought about what's going to happen next year?
I'm not sure at this point what's going to happen. I always stay positive, and, you know, that's the only way I can get through things. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to get 2 more years of DACA or if immigration reform is going to pass sometime soon. So I'm just staying hopeful that something is going to happen that can help my situation.
How important was it to have this authorization for you to get this job?
It was, I mean, I had to get it. Like, if it wasn't for the permit, I wouldn't be able to get any job that I really wanted to work at.
I mean, it makes you wonder if you had gone to the trouble and the expense that you did mm-hmm. to get a college education, a four-year college education at a private university without any public support at all, apart from the education you had from the public education from the age of 13, you might not have had a job at all, or at least one that would mm-hmm. be at all commensurate with your degree.
Yes, definitely. I remember all throughout high school and college hearing people saying, well, what are you going to do after? You know, the question is always there, like, how are you going to find a job? How are you going to do things? But, you know, I just always stay positive and tell youth, like, don't worry about that. Something will happen. Like, you just have to do your part. Just have to work hard. And even though, even if DACA wasn't to happen, I'll still have a degree. And I can go somewhere else where I'm welcome and, you know, do something with it.
On the State of Things today, we're talking about the lives of young immigrants in North Carolina 1 year after DACA. It's the first in our series of conversations about immigration. Danny Moore is with us, director of the Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project at the North Carolina Justice Center. Jasmine Garcia-Rico is a beneficiary of that program. Just ahead, we'll hear about the possibilities for legal stature and status in the future for undocumented students. We're on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking about the anniversary and effects of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival Program, DACA. Last year, the Obama administration offered a temporary solution for young immigrants without documentation who came here as children. Applicants receive a 2-year deferral of deportation and work authorization. Joining us now is Jeremy McKinney. He's an immigration attorney with McKinney, Perry, and Coulter. That's a law firm in Greensboro. He provides legal counsel to DACA applicants. Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Danny Moore, director of Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project at the North Carolina Justice Center. She works with DACA candidates and beneficiaries. And Jasmine Garcia-Rico applied and received work authorization under that policy. So, Jeremy, thousands of young people from North Carolina have applied. Did you see a big influx right after the announcement?
Absolutely. Starting actually in June when the president first made the announcement, which was about 2 months before the actual beginning of the program, we had a huge number of calls and inquiries. So what we were actually forced to do at that point is just conduct many clinics throughout the state just to try to screen young people to see if they would be eligible for the DACA program.
What were some of the legal questions that arose as you try to clear people for application?
Fundamentally, you had to get over people's fear, what you addressed in your first segment, which is just that fear that this is just a temporary reprieve and what would happen when it was over with. DACA is renewable, so, and we know that President Obama will still be in office when this first set of DACA approvals expire. So we feel very confident that those will be renewed. The other questions and fears were about lack of evidence. You have to prove that you entered the United States before reaching your 16th birthday. So the question is, well, what if you weren't in school before your 16th birthday? Or what if you didn't go to the doctor? How are you going to prove it? We've had to deal with many of those issues. And then finally, the question about past criminal convictions, especially traffic offenses. Many counties in this state, there's a close relationship between law enforcement and immigration, and you see many people disproportionately Hispanic that are getting pulled over for driving without a license. Would that impact a DACA application? Now, fundamentally, the Obama administration has said no, and they've proven that to be the case. So we have people with traffic offenses that are still able to get deferred action. But I think it's important to note for the public that if you have a felony or any significant misdemeanor like drunk driving, you cannot participate in this program.
I've seen some charts nationally that indicate the trend in terms of application, and people applied. The peak, it seems to me, was in October. Things have cooled off significantly since then. Was that trend mirrored here in North Carolina?
Absolutely. I mean, at this point, our law firm, we have 3 offices in North Carolina throughout the state, and we filed about a little less than 900 at this point. The vast majority we filed in the fall and early winter of last year. But the amazing thing is how we still continue to see these individuals that are eligible for this program. I mean, We are guessing that only about half of the young people out there that are eligible for this program have actually applied.
Jasmine, what is the conversation, or what was the conversation in your community and communities around the state that you know about when the announcement was made? What were people saying to each other as the debate went on within your communities?
I think a lot of people were confused a little bit because we have heard a lot about the DREAM Act. So they were confused about whether this was a DREAM Act, whether this was going to be something good for them or something risky, as the attorney's saying. So there was a lot of confusion that stayed for a couple months until everyone was able to get a little bit more information about it.
Were there camps? Were there people saying, look, don't do this. It's crazy. It's a trap. You're walking into something. I mean, did people kind of separate that way?
I got a feeling of people wanting to do it. Just because they've been waiting for so long. Some of them didn't have fear about not being able to apply just because of the misdemeanors, like the driving, a lot of tickets and that. But I didn't see a lot of my friends at least saying, no, I'm not going to do it. It's too risky.
Well, Danny, let me ask you, and then I'll ask Jeremy the same question. In terms of faith in the system, if you think about it, you come here, you may have encountered some hostility. There's an awful lot of danger. You're absolutely vulnerable and at risk, and yet there's something about this system that suggests that it's going to play out fairly, and I'm better off participating in this than not, from what I'm hearing from Jasmine.
What we found in working with more than 2,000 people directly all across the state who eventually did apply is that once they had their questions answered and really understood how the program was intended to work, that if they were eligible, they often made the decision to go ahead and apply if they could afford the $465 per person that it cost. People often had questions about whether or not the application itself would be a trigger for deportation. And there were some assurances in the documentation from Citizenship and Immigration Services that said deportation referral would only happen in the case of a national security threat, fraud in the application, or the criminal history that was uncovered through the biometrics, the fingerprinting that happened as part of the application. So people were concerned to make sure that every answer in their application was correct, and that's why legal advice was often important, that they didn't mistakenly answer something incorrectly that could lead to a charge of fraud in the application.
Jeremy, did this surprise you, this what I would infer from the response as a real faith in our system to deliver on its promise?
Absolutely, and I agree with Danny. The administration provided assurances that they would not turn this information over to the enforcement branch, which is called ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, unless there was a criminal or fraud issue, and that is proven to be the case. In addition, it's such a good idea for our dreamers out there to take this leap if they are eligible and get good legal advice to actually do it, because if you look at the Senate Comprehensive Immigration Reform bill, which has passed, and then even ideas floating from the leadership in the House, our dreamers are going to get preferential treatment if immigration reform passes. So that's certainly something else to look at. And I'm not surprised by the faith that these young people have had in the system, because they, frankly, having to take this leap versus continuing to live in the shadows, to me, that's not much of a choice. You take the chance.
Now, let me ask you, and I know, Jeremy, you're a lawyer and you've been working on these cases, and Danny, you're also helping people work their way through. But I want to ask you this question that critics have, which is that in the first place, a rule's a rule, and this suspension of the rule sends the wrong message, and we shouldn't be doing this. We should wait for the legislation, and what the administration did was just wrong to suspend a rule that is on the books. Let me ask you about that, Jeremy.
I teach immigration law at Elon, and on the first day, I instruct all of my students of a fundamental rule of immigration law. In no other area of the law does the executive branch, the president, have more power to control our borders. It's a question of national security. The president can make these decisions and has made these decisions for centuries in terms of how our borders are going to be controlled and who gets to come in and who has to leave. This is no departure from that pattern at all. Every day, the administration has to make decisions as to how it is going to go about enforcing the law. Right now, ICE enforcement is stretched very thin. Are we going to concentrate on young people like Jasmine, who haven't done anything but contribute positively to our society, or are we going to focus those enforcement resources on the bad guys out there, folks that are hurting people, folks that are national security threats? I think it's just smart public policy and consistent with our history.
Danny, what about there's another concern that people who've applied for this and gotten it will have a leg up in some ways on full citizenship, depending on how legislation pans out, if it's ever written. And also that there are people in the pipeline who have gone about it through the regular means, and that this was a kind of an express route to authorization.
Well, I don't really see it as an express route. I do see it as part of the very limited way in. We talk about there's no way in under current immigration law for so many people, especially large numbers of people from Mexico and Central America. So, in fact, deferred action is such a limited benefit, and it's also just the smallest step that somebody could take towards regularizing their status. I think that in as much as people have been trying to do things the right way, as we always hear, there has just not been a right way for so many immigrants living in North Carolina to do so until this program was announced.
Jeremy, is there a time frame for authorities to respond once you make the application? What's the average wait to find out?
At the beginning of the program, it was typically taking less than 90 days. Now, just due to resources on the part of Citizenship and Immigration Services, our adjudications now are about 4 to 6 months, which I think is a bit long, but I think this program is kind of a dress rehearsal for a larger reform effort should something pass from Congress.
What's the success rate among applicants? What percentage actually get approved?
Well, in our firm, we've only had one denial, and that was just for lack of evidence of entry prior to age 16. We've had overwhelming success, but that goes back to what Danny said earlier, careful legal screening to make sure that the young people that are applying for the program are actually eligible.
And I saw Brookings released a report just recently that showed nationally about 1% are rejected, so most of them are going through. Nationally, and I guess that's probably pretty similar here in North Carolina. Danny, one of the other interesting things is that this careful vetting process, Jeremy talked about something like a dress rehearsal. I mean, is this a way for us to, first of all, get data on a population that has so far gone sort of unreported, right? And also find a way through the maze of difficulties and challenges that arise when we talk about immigration policy?
We definitely saw it, in addition to being one of the first good news remedies that we'd heard about in years, we also saw it as a dress rehearsal for comprehensive immigration reform where a broader legalization might be possible. You know, there's been a stalemate in Congress for many years, and we're pleased to see some movement in the Senate. There's a lot of uncertainty about what may happen in the House. In fact, the House Judiciary Committee recently voted to deport the DACA folks, which was just a devastating piece of bad news. We hope that the House will get their act together and figure out some fair and reasonable, workable solutions on immigration. And we feel like all of these partnerships that we developed all across the state with local Latino centers, with immigrant organizations, and with groups like SAF, Student Action with Farmworkers, and Catholic Charities, others who regularly do this work with immigrants, is really the kind of groundwork we need to lay in order to have the capacity to respond to a much broader legalization program, which we haven't had in decades.
How have you and how are you doing outreach for DACA?
Well, a lot through the community partners, a lot through fact sheets in 5 languages, a bilingual video that we used for community education purposes. But because we're based in Raleigh and we're a statewide policy organization, it was really up to community partners around the state who regularly run youth groups, run theater projects, run mothers groups. They were the ones who had these direct relationships, would invite 50 to 100 people into a community education workshop where we were present, helping people learn about the program, and then following up and inviting them into legal clinics, which we had subsequently.
Jasmine, do you find yourself speaking to those groups?
I remember at that time I wasn't working with SAF. I just had a regular job, but I did speak to a lot of people. A lot of my friends always come to me asking for questions for some reason. You know, I would try to find the answer for them and, like, reach out to community organizations, as Danny mentioned, to get more information and feed them in.
Do you get the feeling there are a lot of eyes on you right now, people holding back, waiting to see how Jasmine does?
I think so. I was one of the first ones, I feel, to apply and to get the DACA permit in Burlington, at least, I feel. So a lot of people were just waiting to see what would happen to me.
Jeremy, what do you think accounts for the trail off in applicants? Do you think we've seen kind of the total number of people who are willing to take this chance and go through the process?
I think we've seen the majority, but I still think there's a significant part of our undocumented population that either haven't heard of the program or are still too fearful to apply. Again, just in the last 2 weeks, our firm has seen at least six young people that are fully eligible that have not applied. And so, you know, we're having those conversations every day about those. So they're still out there, but I think the majority at this point has applied.
Danny, we talked about the fact that we can now collect data on these populations and know more about what's happening with our immigrant populations. What have you learned? What are some of the outcomes, maybe things that you hadn't expected just in this first year?
Well, we've learned that there are a number of questions that the families have about what the process will entail, whether it's about getting a job after you get your Social Security number and work authorization, whether it's about getting a driver's license. That's been a top issue for immigrant communities all over the state for several years, and also what it means in terms of higher education. So some of these are still pending legal policy battles that we're having to fight in North Carolina. And as much as that something like deferred action opens doors to a driver's license, to higher education, and to better careers for people, we'll see that people continue to want to take advantage of these programs.
Jeremy, what have you learned just from a legal standpoint in this particular program? And I wonder, you teach immigration policy, as you said. What have you learned about maybe crafting immigration policy that wasn't so clear to you before this program emerged?
Well, the main difference between DACA and past programs like Temporary Protected Status, or TPS, is that the government didn't make a distinction between traffic offenses and non-traffic offenses. That's been a critical, critical difference from a legal perspective that opens the doors to many North Carolinians to apply for this program. That's been the first surprising thing from a legal standpoint. Just from a personal standpoint, it's just been amazing to see how many kids that had either dropped out of school or had not pursued higher education using the DACA opportunity as an incentive to get back in school. It's been an amazing thing to witness and to be a part of.
One of the criterion, of course, was that you finish school or be in school or be on your way to college or have a GED. So if you dropped out and you wanted this, you need to get back or get a GED. Wanted to point that out. Jasmine, also a question about whether or not everybody was on board and on the same page once this authorization was released. You had an experience at the Department of Motor Vehicles when you went to get your driver's license after it was authorized. Tell us about it.
Yes. So after I got my permit and Social Security, like the first thing I wanted to do is go get my license because I had to drive without a license for 5-6 years. So I went, and the person who greeted me there was a little bit not so welcoming. I feel like he was trying to intimidate me a little bit. He looked at me and he asked me if I had been there before. And I said, no, it's my first time. And he looked at me and he said, are you sure? Because I've seen you here before. So it was kind of an experience for me trying to stand strong and tell him, no, it's my first time and I just want to get my license. And he kept asking me questions all throughout the time I was there, like, when did you arrive? I told him I just got here. I didn't want to go into details with him or, you know, tell him anything about me that could involve not getting my license.
Mm-hmm.
So he kept asking me questions like, why do you speak English if you just arrived and things like that. But I just try to stay quiet and get through it.
And you did.
Yes.
What about travel? Does it make traveling back to Mexico for you any more safe?
Not at all. I thought that I would be able to go back. I haven't seen my dad in 11 years. I haven't seen my grandma. Well, she passed away a couple months ago. And I was trying to go for those reasons. So I looked at the information on the website, and they said that you could go if it was for like educational, humanitarian, or work-related reasons. So I reached out to my attorney, and they mentioned to me that it was kind of up in the air, that it was going to be a little bit challenging, that we didn't know if I was going to be able to come back. So I talked to my family, and we all decided that it was better for me to stay.
Yeah, it's one thing to get that experience at the DMV, quite another at the border, so you decided to stay back. Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for talking with us, all of you.
Thank you.
Jasmine Garcia Rico is a DACA beneficiary. Jeremy McKinney, attorney at McKinney, Perry & Coulter. Danny Moore, director of the Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project at the North Carolina Justice Center. Coming up, we're going to test my spelling skills. That will not go well, but we'll talk about an adult spelling bee just ahead. Stay TUNED.